hit it. Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 25th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Ketofol. Does it take two to make a procedure go right? Our guest skeptic today is Dr. Steve Carroll. Steve is an emergency medicine physician and EM core faculty with the U.S. Army at San Antonio Military Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. He also does this awesome podcast called EM Basic that is your boot camp guide to emergency medicine. EM Basic reviews common EM topics at the level of a medical student or intern. Welcome back to the SGEM, Steve.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you on, Steve. Now, you've been away for a while serving your country.
Yes, that's right. I was deployed for a few months and I got back in the beginning of December.
Well, I am glad you're both home safe and sound and doing well. But you need to make a disclaimer before we continue.
So as anyone who listens to EM Basic knows, what I say here does not represent the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, or the Shawshank Emergency Medicine Residency. There.
All right, so let's kickstart this episode on Ketofol with a case.
So the case is a 40-year-old male comes to the emergency department with a dislocated shoulder while playing football. He's a weekend warrior, has never had any shoulder dislocations in the past. It took him about an hour to get to the emergency department. After some pain control, you try the Cunningham and scapular manipulation techniques to get the shoulder back in, but they're not working. You decide that the patient needs procedural sedation. One of your residents asks you, I've heard about this Ketofol thing. Can we try it in this patient?
Ketofol use has been rising in popularity in the EM and pediatric EM community. Ketofol refers to the combination of ketamine, which we talked about using in a subdissociative dose for pain control recently, and propofol. It is often mixed in the same syringe, but some people out there like to choose to give it separately. The theory is that the two medications can make a procedure go right by canceling out the bad effects of each other.
So the thing is that propofol tends to cause hypotension and sometimes apnea, whereas ketamine usually raises the blood pressure and doesn't affect the respiratory drive. On the flip side, ketamine tends to cause vomiting when emerging from its effects, whereas propofol has some antiemetic properties.
So the clinical question we're going to try to answer today is, how does propofol compare to ketofol mixed in a 1-to-1 ratio compared to ketofol mixed in a 4-to-1 ratio for adults requiring procedural sedation in the emergency department? So what reference did you pick for this podcast, Steve?
So this was titled A Randomized Double-Blinded Clinical Trial of Propofol, 1-to-1 propofol and ketamine, and 4-to-1 propofol and ketamine for deep procedural sedation in the emergency department. Annals of Emergency Medicine, currently in press.
And so let's go through the PICO. What was the population?
The population was adults 18 and over presenting to the ED requiring procedural sedation for a painful ED procedure.
And what was the intervention?
Propofol ketamine or ketofol at 1-to-1 ratio or propofol ketamine at a 4-to-1 ratio, heavy on the propofol and ketamine light.
All right. And what were they comparing it to?
Propofol alone.
And what were their outcomes, Steve?
So the primary outcome was number and proportion of subjects experiencing airway or respiratory adverse events leading to an intervention. As far as the secondary outcomes, there were a few. Lowest oxygen saturation during the procedure, success of the procedure, recovery agitation, the patient's pain scale, memory of the procedure by the patient, and patient satisfaction with the procedure.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, we found a similar frequency of airway and respiratory adverse events leading to interventions between propofol alone and either a 1-to-1 or 4-to-1 ketofol, end of quote. Let's go through the 11 quality checklists for randomized clinical trials. The first question, Steve, is, was the study population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes, it was.
Were the patients adequately randomized?
Yes.
Was the randomized process concealed?
Yes.
did the patients get analyzed into the groups which they were randomized?
Yes, they were.
Question number 5. The study patients, were they recruited consecutively?
Yes, they were. There was 24/7 enrollment with trained research assistants in the ED.
The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes.
And were all the participants, this means the patients, the clinicians, and the outcome assessors, were they unaware of group allocation?
In general, yes. All the syringes looked the same, and they were prepared ahead of time.
Question 8. All groups were treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes.
And was the follow-up complete?
Yes, it was.
And were all patient-important outcomes considered?
Yes, they were.
And the final question, question number 11, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
This is the one that we're unsure about, and we'll discuss a little more.
Well, then why don't we go through the key results now?
So there was no statistically significant difference in the primary composite outcome. In the propofol group, it was 32%. In the 1-to-1 ketofol group, it was 22%. And the 4-to-1 ketofol group, it was 33%. Once again, these were not statistically significant. So as far as the secondary outcomes, they were similar between the three groups as well. The only exception was that there was more recovery agitation in the ketofol 1-to-1 group and the ketofol 4-to-1 group as compared to propofol alone.
Well, this would be expected since ketamine is known to cause recovery agitation. However, the clinical significance of this is uncertain. The authors didn't mention whether any patient had recovery agitation that was significant enough to require treatment or that the patient remembered after the procedure. But let's take a look at this critically here, Steve. And I had a few concerns. How many concerns? Yes, you may have guessed it. 5 concerns. So why don't we just alternate through those concerns?
Okay.
So the first one I had was the composite endpoint. And while composite endpoints make for the bigger target that are easier to hit, each component may not be of equal importance to the patient. They had 6 components in this composite outcome, and they included hypoxia, central apnea, subclinical respiratory depression, complete airway obstruction, laryngospasm, and aspiration. And you know what? There were 0 events for half, that's 3 out of the 6, of the components in that composite outcome for any of the intervention. And the most common adverse component was subclinical respiratory depression, 51 out of 271 patients, or 19%. How important is this event?
Probably not too important. The second issue we had were the surrogate endpoints. The authors used definitions from previous studies concerning their endpoints. However, some of these don't represent patient-oriented outcomes, like the recovery agitation. The authors did recognize this as a limitation to their study.
And the third thing, Steve, I wanted to bring up was the unblinding. Like you said, they did a good job in attempting to blind the physicians to the group allocations by having the syringes look identical. Despite this strategy, physicians were able to guess group allocations more than chance. They were able to guess that the 1-to-1 group 58% of the time. And this could have unblinded the study and introduced some bias. Bias, of course, being defined as moving the results away from the truth.
The fourth issue was the power calculation. The anticipated approximately 30% adverse composite outcome. When you look at their results, they were pretty close with an observed range from a low of 19% in the 1-to-1 group to a high of 32% in the 4-to-1 group. However, they set their sample size on a 20% difference in their primary outcome. So why did they pick such a large number? There was a 10% difference between propofol versus 1-to-1 ratio, an 11% difference between the 1-to-1 ratio versus 4-to-1 ratio. If the sample size were larger, would there be a regression to the mean, or would this difference actually hold up? If the latter, the NNT would be 10, favoring the 1-to-1 ratio.
And the final point I wanted to make, Steve, was patient-oriented outcome. The composite adverse outcomes may not have been that important to the patients, especially when the intervention to address the problems were providing a little supplemental oxygen, bagging the patient, repositioning the patient during the procedure, or stimulating the patient to induce ventilation. There was no patient in any of the 3 groups that needed an airway adjunct. an important patient-oriented secondary outcome was satisfaction with the procedure. And there were more patients were satisfied with propofol alone, 85%, compared to the 1-to-1 ratio, 71%. Now, the study was not powered to make any conclusions on secondary outcomes, but the results could generate hypothesis for future study. But let's comment on our conclusions and compare them to the author's conclusions. And in this case, the conclusions made by the author seem to be a bit misleading. A more accurate conclusion would be there was not a greater than 20% difference in the composite outcome, respiratory and airway adverse events, between propofol alone versus either 1-to-1 propofol and ketamine ratio or a 4-to-1 ratio. But Steve, you got to give us a bottom line on this paper.
So here's the bottom line. Ketofol in a 1-to-1 or 4-to-1 ratio doesn't appear to have a greater than 20% benefit, i.e. less adverse respiratory or airway events, compared to propofol alone.
And how about you resolve that case you presented to us at the start of the podcast?
So for the case, you and the resident both take a look at this article and decide to proceed with just propofol for the sedation, since it will require less nursing time and less potential for medication errors in mixing as compared to propofol. As always, you do a good pre-procedure assessment of the airway, as well as doing a good history and physical. You get all your airway equipment to the bedside, check your equipment, and size it appropriately. You also have the RSI kit at the bedside just in case. The patient receives the propofol, and you successfully reduce the patient's shoulder on the first attempt without any respiratory issues.
So from a clinical application standpoint, I'm generally going to provide some IV opioids for pain control, usually fentanyl in my case, and then I follow that up with propofol for the procedural sedation. But what are you going to tell patients, Steve?
So what I would tell the patient is, we're going to use propofol to sedate you to help put your shoulder back in. Propofol is a very safe drug that we have a lot of experience using in our emergency department. The side effects are rare and may include having to breathe for you with a mask or rarely put a tube down your throat. But we will watch you closely and be prepared for any possible problems ahead of time.
There you go. Well, that sound reminds me that it's time for the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Andrew Hamilton, an orthopedic technician from Collingwood General and Marine Hospital. He knew that it was Dr. Alexander Hamilton, perhaps a distant relative, who was the military surgeon from Scotland whose first trial to demonstrate allocation bias or randomization in his paper called The Inaugural Medical Dissertation on Camp Fever. All right, Steve, what's the Keener or Gunner question this week?
So the Keener question is, San Antonio Military Medical Center used to be called Brooke Army Medical Center, and some people still call it that today. So who is Brooke Army Medical Center named after? What was his rank? And what is his claim to medical fame?
Well, if you know the answer to this military Keener question, then send me an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Gunner in the subject line, and the first person to correctly answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, we have some conferences coming up. There's the Rural and Remote Medicine course in April 9th to 11th in Montreal, and then there is Steel Beam in the Hammer, Hamilton, Ontario, April 20th to 21st. Then we'll be Lighting the Way at CAPE in Edmonton, Alberta, May 30th to June 3rd. And then finally, SMACK, Chicago, June 23rd to 26th. I have to tell you, it is great having you back on the SGEM, Steve.
Well, thanks a lot for having me back, Ken.
Now, we mentioned earlier that you were in the U.S. military. Would you be kind enough to give the SGEM tagline as if you were a drill sergeant?
Sir, yes, sir. Remember, Private, to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Oh, we'll talk to everyone next week.